Today, 8 megatrends for the years ahead. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news. Today, I'm joined by Damien Klassen from Nucleus Wealth and What the World Funds. Hi, Damien. Now, we're going to have a big conversation about the long-term trends and, you know, mega trends. It's interesting because, of course, we get caught up in the short-term ups and downs of markets and the latest hype. But underlying it, there are some really, really important longer-term things going on too. And I think it's important we don't lose sight of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a number of them as well that are, you know, we've been through this sort of 50-odd year trend changes or 50-year trends where they've been rising or falling. And we're hitting some interesting parts in a number of them. So, you know, they're not the things that are going to capture the headlines, but over the next sort of 5-10 years, it's just going to be inexorable. You know, these trends are going to be affecting investments everywhere.
And just before we get into it, let's just think about the relationship between those long-term trends, productivity, and, you know, the short-term debt cycle and macroeconomic cycles, those things, because they're all sort of part of a continuum. And yet, actually, these longer-term trends ultimately probably have more of a significant impact if you look back and say, gee, like the rise of the internet. I remember in the early days of the internet, everyone was saying, oh, it's you know, it's either hype or it's going to be the change of everything. If you look back now, it was a significant mega change that really came through, but it came through over a longer period of time. So it's important to understand where this fits in.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a lot of, I'll go through a couple of demographic ones, and they're the classic ones, just in terms of saying, you know, as the baby boomers move through their sort of life cycle, is they just influence everything as they go. And so that's the, you know, keeping in mind that that's going to be a 20-year, it's going to play out over a 20-year period. You know, it's not something you're going to rush out and buy something today and sell it tomorrow. But when you look back at the time, you can just say, oh, right, I can very clearly see how that was affecting. And I've got that chart up. I use that productivity. I mean, I sort of talk about it really in terms of saying I've stolen the chart from Ray Dalio, but it's really saying, well, there's this underlying trend that's sort of going and going up or down. And then you've got the shorter term cycles that are, so the longer term trend is sort of the equivalent of that straight line going up. So let's say it's the baby boomers and aging or something like that. Is that's just inexorably happening. Then you have these cycles going over the top of that, and these sort of longer term ones. And then you have these shorter term cycles as well going up and down sort of over those periods. And you lose track of that. But really, that, you know, over that long period of time, that's the thing that sort of really matters. And so I thought I'd drop in though my first long-term trend is inequality. And that's one which, you know, we've just seen decades and decades of inequality and the top 1% just ending up with more and more proportions, depending upon, you know, whether you want to do it by income, whether you want to do it by assets. They all point in the same direction, that the bottom 50% has just got less and less, and the top 1% or 0.01%, depending upon how you want to measure it, just end up with more and more. And that's a trend that's not changing, you know, at the moment. It's something I think we should be keeping an eye on, because it plays so much of a role in things like demand. We see inflation. I think there was a great example during the pandemic where we saw governments try and spend a lot of money getting money out to as many people as they can, and particularly lower paid people. And we saw this huge boom in inflation. And so that reminder that actually when you spread the money out and let more people do things, they actually want to get out and spend it. Whereas you let it all pile up with the richest, and they just want to get out and invest it. You know, an extra $1,000 to Gina Rinehart, she's probably just going to throw that on the pile and go and invest it. You know, you give $1,000 to you know, a homeless person on the street, they're going to rush out and spend it as fast as they can. And so I'd see that sort of contrast between that, and when we do see some genuine change in that, you're going to need to change your entire investment outlook. But for the moment, particularly under Trump, really can't see any changes in this.
And 2 points to that quickly. The first is, of course, it's the silent majority of people who are actually down the income distribution and wealth distribution, who are often the ones being crushed by the current policies. I think of rental stress and mortgage stress in Australia and other places around the world, whereas it's the very vocal minority who actually seem to have all the power, all the wealth, And in fact, all of the policies that are being influenced by politicians who tend to be more connected with the wealthy and the big corporates sort of suggests that sometimes the levers are being pulled in a way that benefits the few rather than the many quite deliberately. And so one of the big questions here is, well, is the political system that we've currently got actually working in favor of or against inequality versus actually, equality? And if it is true that most of the political decisions are being made by people who are actually at the more in the wealthy sector of the market, who are actually more influenced by those big, powerful guys and by those players who are big internationally speaking, what does that say about the way that the politics and the economy is actually set up at the moment?
Yeah, nothing good, nothing good. I guess I'd say there's two parts I watch. One is saying, is there going to are people voting for the more populist measures? And that's certainly true in a lot of a lot of this splintering between left and right and populists on both sides that are attracting a lot more vote than they used to. The major parties in Australia is a good example. Used to routinely get 40-50% of the vote, and now they're both in the low 30s potentially the Liberal Party even lower than that, I think now. Yes. And so it's this idea that you've got this splintering. Now, the sad thing with not to say that the past is definitely going to be what happens in the future, but the sad thing is, usually what happens is populists rise up and say, I can solve this problem for you, a la Trump, and then they go ahead and don't solve the problem. They just go and do what they were going to do anyway. But the typical political reaction is not to then swing back to the middle. It's actually to vote in somebody even more extremist. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping that's not where we go. But, I think certainly looking at the political environment where we are and saying, look, it does look like, as you said, we've set up this system where corporates can put their thumb on the scale and make donations and do whatever it is to get what they want. And that sort of exacerbates this problem, but it keeps happening until one day it doesn't. And that's the part where, whether it's it starts with something like your Wall Street protests and actually morphs into something, or whether maybe we're in the situation now where the Wall Street protests can go on for a few weeks and then everyone gets bored and goes away and forgets about it. And so that's, I don't know what the answer is, but I know it's a very important question, and we should keep watching what's going on in that space.
Yeah, because
that's really going to drive what you should be investing in.
Because ultimately it comes back to the meaning of democracy, the meaning of society, and the meaning of the economy, and those are huge, big picture questions which we should keep in our minds, because, as you say, it does have a significant impact on where you're going to invest, how you're going to invest, and who you're backing into the future. Let's move the conversation forward, because the other angle on this, of course, is demographics. So we've seen significant shifts both in terms of migration but also in terms of age and other things around the place, and that's having a huge profound impact. Look at China, for example, or look at Japan. And now we're even starting to see some of the similar themes coming through into Australia too. This is a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got this part where you're hitting sort of a double dependency rate. So we've got these dependency ratios, which is how many workers do you have for retirees and children? And you go back into sort of 50s and 60s, and I've got this dotted line on there, which is showing your child dependency. So back in the 1960s, for example, when we're peaking out, often it would be the husband working, five kids at home or six kids at home, the wife with them. So you've sort of got one person, effectively working for all these people not working, and then maybe some grandparents as well not working. And so you've sort of got this really high dependency ratio. So as that fell, that was great for economically speaking. So we got women into the workplace, which we'll actually deal with as a separate one. But you got the aging of that sort of big cohort of people who had plenty of brothers and sisters, and then the number of children per woman came down, and so we saw this sort of baby boomers move through. And so now we've got so that was this great sort of 50-year trend where dependency ratios, the number of people working compared to the number of people not working, just fell as the children, number of children fell, and older people were still young. Now we're hitting this sort of inflection point where baby boom is starting to retire, so that's starting to lift. We can see that we're actually sort of in this period now where, after that long period of falling, now we're in quite a sharp rising in terms of the dependency ratios. And the longer people live, the more we're going to see that rise. And so that again, makes a huge difference to the overall what products are people are buying, where are they putting their money, what's the value of labor in terms of, if you've got lots of workers, then labor can be cheaper. When workers are disappearing, now you've got to think about all the effects that they have. And so, and maybe that'll be over, that maybe that'll be swamped by things like AI or technological factors. But we just need to keep in mind that's happening already, that we've got. So if we're losing big chunks of the workforce, and AI is making things more product, adding productivity and getting rid of workers, maybe that just all cancels out because of this demographic trend we've got in some of the more advanced countries. But maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's, which one's going to tip the seesaw more? That's really what we need to be thinking about. And absent AI, I would have said, yeah, we're in for a period of falling productivity and problems with more people not working. And so, the question then is, which one wins out? But it's certainly, you shouldn't be looking at these, should, you shouldn't be looking at AI without sort of considering the demographics and the sort of natural retirement rate that we're going to be having as well.
And that's one of the reasons why the migration question is so critical, right? Because if effectively the replacement rate through birth rates continues to fall, it means that the overall population is going to drop unless you actually can supplement it by higher migration, which is interesting, one of the reasons perhaps why we see strong attempts, or we've had seen strong attempts for high migration. But in Europe, now that migration thing has turned sour. And people are now wanting to push back against it. In Australia, we've still got very high migration at the moment. And what that means is that we don't have the ability to plan ahead like we used to, because, if you have birth rates rising, in 5 years' time you're going to take school and then 15 years, university, et cetera. But now suddenly you need it all immediately. So this whole shift is fascinating, because it then takes you to a broader question about, well, where in the world is population growth strong? And it's true that in some parts of the world it's still very strong. And what are the cultural norms there versus what are the cultural norms that we have now? And so this is why this whole demographics, migration, mix shift is so critical. And actually having a view on that, again, is going to shape your investment thoughts, isn't it?
And there's an interesting correlation versus causation thing as well in terms of companies, sorry, not companies, countries' development. So you very much notice that countries, as they develop, as a population rate slows, their development goes really, lifts off, and they often get much better economic growth. And China is a great example of this. The one child policy comes in, and off they go. Now, whether that's, I don't want to cherry pick one example, but we'll use that as a test case. The question is it which is coming first? So is it the idea that as you get richer, people have more kids, stop having as many kids, and you reduce that amount, and so that's what's sort of driving this? Or maybe there's a certain part about saying, well, as you have fewer kids, governments can stop worrying about, oh, I've just got to build more, I've got to build more roads, I've got to build more schools, I've got to build more of this, I've got to build more cities, and I've got to do this. It's all about the growth part. And they can actually go, well, now we're not worried about chasing our tail in terms of growth. Now we can actually worry about making things better. How do we make existing ones better? How do we make them more productive and give people, a better individual outcome? And so, I don't think that's, I don't think either's completely right, but I do think there's more of a play in both directions of what the what often gets accounted for. And Australia's probably a great example of that, is saying, if we weren't running such huge rates, and we didn't have to build all this extra infrastructure and infill all these cities, what would our politicians be doing with their time? How would they be making, the existing infrastructure more productive, rather than just trying to go, I've just got to build more to cater for the latest influx?
Well, as we'll see later, the tax take and how that's changing is also another impact here, of course, because if you can get more people to come in, they can pay more tax. And the Treasury loves that, but there are implications. But we should move on and talk a little bit about the female participation, because this is another factor that is fundamentally changed compared with 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, but also yeah. So the thought here is you go okay, and look, there's a whole bunch of different ways you can measure this, but I've chosen just the female participation rate as one, and then there's a female percentage of the labor force is another. But so I'm using the US on this first chart, and you can see it's sort of risen from less than 15% in 1966, and rose pretty rapidly through to the 2000s where we hit 50%. But really, since then, it really hasn't gone very far. And so, not to say that I'm not saying that's a bad thing or whatever it is. All I'm saying is that was a great tailwind for economics over that entire period where, similar to that dependency ratio, we just had more people working in the economy, more money being generated, more people going out and spending that money. There's a certain virtuous growth cycle you get from that. And that tailwind's come to an end. And arguably, in some countries, you can sort of see that, Finland or Sweden, you can see, look, is it actually starting to hit a rate where maybe that's even starting to fall a little bit? And so maybe it's getting to more of a choice for people in certain situations. And so, if that's the case, then that says other things about the growth rate. Can you get the same growth we saw? Do you look back over the last 50 years and say, oh, that's just typical? Or do you go, no, we were driven by demographics, and we're driven by female participation that actually made a lot of these figures look a lot higher than what they ordinarily would be.
Yeah, and I'll make the point there that, of course, with higher female participation, it means that, for example, lending ratios for mortgages now assumes two full-time incomes rather than one and a bit full-time incomes, which means that you can borrow more, which means that you can actually get a bigger mortgage, which means that you can stoke house prices higher, which means the banks benefit relative to other parts of the economy. So there are profound consequences of this. The other side of it, of course, is that the childcare costs, because if both parents are going out to work, it means that they have to be able to afford childcare, or the government has to provide childcare to make that happen. So again, there are profound implications in terms of the structure of society where investments are made. And all of these things, you stand back and think, gee, we've come a long way in relatively short periods of time, but can we continue in that direction, or is that perhaps now reaching some natural limits?
Exactly. And that's the part I think where, when you go from one person working to two people working, as you said, in your calculation is about how much I can lend. That's this great increase in, I can just every year I can just offer people bigger and bigger mortgages because I'm, 1 year I'm saying, okay, it's 1.7 times employers. Now it's 1.75. Now it's 1.8. Now, but once you hit two, okay, that's it. Now I've got both of them working until you started getting to the part as well. Oh, okay, now I'm going to need to get, let me factor in that you're going to have adult kids living with you as well and get them to be paying off mortgages. There is this natural limit to this.
Which sort of explains why it is that we've got more people now working multiple jobs, right? Because now two incomes is not sufficient to be able to actually cover the costs for a lot of people, which goes right back to our inequality conversation before. And it connects very nicely to the next point that actually, whilst everybody's talking about public sector debt, the real sleeper here, the real concern is the amount of private debt in the system.
Yeah, particularly in Australia, is the amount of is that switch across, and this is actually I've got to throw a few extra years in here, but that's yeah, this is just the private debt is just taking off in terms of Australia, and globally this has been the case. We saw within the US a pretty big dent was made by the financial crisis, so their private debt did fall a lot, but Canada's kept on ticking on, a lot of Europe kept ticking on in terms of just that idea that we're just switching higher and higher private debts. And so it's sort of an interesting, in some ways you say, isn't debt's this great thing where, it's a trust. It's basically saying, we've got trust in that we can let people, I can give you some money to go out and build the house that you want or get the car that you want with a trust that, eventually you'll be able to pay that back over time and things like that. And you sort of say, isn't that a nice thing? And the flip side is you say, well, actually, maybe what's happening is we're not actually paying people enough. And because we're not paying people enough, they still want things. They still want to be able to buy houses and cars and stuff like that. So what we'll do rather than paying them more is we'll just let them borrow more. And that's obviously got its limits as well. Is it at some point that needs to, that relationship needs to change. And part of and that and I do think a lot of that comes back to that inequality side as well, is that there's a part about if all the money's going to a small group of people and they're just piling up all this extra money, well, what are they going to do with it? They're going to lend it out to other people in order to, in order to make more money as their companies. Whereas once the money gets spread out more, people then get to pay down their debts, and people don't need the debts in the first place. And so that's, I think that's, it's a little bit, it's not completely the same as the inequality, but I think there's a lot of interrelationship between the two.
And I'll make another point here, and that is that the high private debt as well as higher government debt now, those are both inflationary. And one of the interesting things, if you look at the total money supply flows and it continues to rise, that actually explains one of the critical factors as to why higher inflation is in now. And it's going to be much harder to squeeze it out the system because the money supply is still rising and it's private debt more than public debt that's actually responsible for it. And that means that we are going to see banks continuing to be able to probably lend more because they're now lending for longer terms and 2 times income, as we said, and 35, 40-year mortgages, lower debt-to-income ratios, all of those things. And regulators now are trying to actually get their head around that. So there are really profound consequences of this huge amount of debt. And of course, debt has to be repaid. And both public debt and private debt means that ultimately people are having to pay more interest on those larger amounts. Those interest payments are going back to those wealthy individuals and those wealthy firms. And so again, it's part of this same inequality conversation.
And then as well, this is the other trend that you said. We spoke about the two demographics trends that are changing. So we're going through this change in what they've done. The inequality one and this debt one, they aren't changing. This is the part about, as we've just seen in Australia, now we want 5% down mortgages because, what does a first home buyer need? A much bigger debt. So let's help them. Let's do what we can to get more and more debt piled into those people. And I don't see any breaks in this trend as yet either.
So let's move on to the next one and talk about taxation, because we know in Australia the amount of tax that private individuals are paying as a proportion of GDP, it's grown and it's almost reaching a high that we've never seen before. And there's no way it's going to reverse. The latest MIIFO that's come out today suggests that that's going to continue. But the trends actually longer term, well, they tell a rather different story.
So now I'm talking about corporates. And the reason why I want to focus on corporates here is because I'm really interested in I'm talking about investments mainly and share market investments. What can you expect in terms of earnings from companies over long periods of time? And if we look back at the last 50 years, we've just had this crazy drop in corporate tax rates from pretty close to 50% for corporate tax rates. And now we're sort of getting down to 20% and potentially below. We've seen another raft of tax cuts in from Trump, or extensions of tax credits there. And the idea is here that, okay, so we've had this, we're looking at earnings growth. What's the earnings growth been for companies? And you're looking at 50-year averages and saying, well, that's 50 years is a long time. You should be able to get a reasonable feel for that. And my rough sort of figure on it is, we've had this growth, EPS growth of about six, a little bit over 6%, and almost a quarter of that has come from tax cuts. So the idea that you've basically been able to rely as an investor in the equity market for the last 50 years, you've been able to rely on the fact that I'm going to get 1.5%, 1 to 1.5% growth every year because taxes are just going to get cut and cut and cut and cut, and so my earnings will grow. And so there's that. That thought behind it. Now, this doesn't look like it's changing either, but we're getting closer to zero. So it is a there's less and less. It's much, you obviously get a lot more as you're cutting from 50% down to 40%, gets you a lot more than cutting from 20% down to 15. But there's a it's something to keep an eye on in terms of what you're putting into what your expectations are for what corporate's going to do in terms of growth. We should be watching this. I don't think there's any reason to be alarmed yet if you're investing and in investing in these companies, but it is worth keeping in mind that it could change at some point. A populist politician who decides, well, maybe companies should pay tax. And also the part about, well, we are just getting closer and closer to zero, so the effect is just getting less and less as the closer and closer we get.
And the interesting thing, of course, is that companies have a lot of lobbying power with regard to governments. And so they've been quite successful in playing governments one off against another and saying, well, I could get a lower tax rate if I go and build in Ireland, say, or compared with Australia. So there's a sort of a downward force there. But like I say, the problem is that if you look at government spending, which is continuing to rise, what it means is that governments have to fund more and more and more from personal taxation. So the yin and the yang of all this, if you want to have lower taxes for corporates and higher returns for corporates, well, everybody else has to pay through higher taxes. And so this idea of, well, is that going to ultimately hit a point where the populist view is, no, hang on, we can't afford to pay anymore. And if that's the case, then this ball game could change. But at the moment, I don't see much view that is going to change. And if you look at Trump in the US or and what he's doing there, or if you look at what other countries are doing, particularly in Europe, they're still wanting to keep the corporate tax rate as low as possible.
Yeah, and Australia's got this thing where, we haven't seen that much in the way of tax cuts within Australia at a headline level, but we have it at an underlying level because we give a little tax back. So, or we give you tax credits on it. And in particular, Costello's changed to the franking credits, where he basically said, okay, you don't even have to pay tax. So, originally franking credits was, we don't want you to pay tax twice. Whereas Costello's effectively for retirees was, well, you don't have to pay tax at all, as long as as long as you're with that. And so while Australia's headline rate hasn't fallen, the fact that we give away franking credits means that actually we are lowering a corporate tax rate, but just because we make them pay it and then we give it back to the shareholders.
And of course, in Australia, a lot of corporates get significant tax breaks and handouts as well, which is another factor. And of course, though, they are lobbying for that continued support. So the government support for the corporate sector is rising dramatically at a very point in time when the overall government debt's rising and the tax take for individuals is rising. And that means that at some point we're going to hit bounds. And talking about hitting bounds, what about the trade story? Because, of course, the trade story is really fascinating, particularly with Trump's interventions this year on tariffs.
So I mean, this really peaked sort of financial crisis. So we sort of peaked out. So we had this rising again for 50 years. Trade just every year could rely on trade being more and more and more. Now we've spent a decade and a half now. We're going sideways. Trump's certainly trying to put a dent in it, and I think you probably, that middle section of the end there from Trump 1.0, you can probably factor a little bit on him. I don't know on this one. I think it's worth noting that he's certainly trying. I don't think he can do it. And as you said, it's this part you were talking about, the rising power of the companies. And so they're obviously out there lobbying. Not only are they out there lobbying for tax breaks, but they're also lobbying out there for free trade. And I want to be able to sell my stuff everywhere. And who do I need to pay? Which politicians do I need to pay elsewhere that will give me this deal? And so I think this is probably, I'm not expecting this to fall, but I must admit I'm not entirely confident in either direction. So it's it's your vested interests, some powerful vested interests, acting in both directions, and I think there's a certain element, I think, of even with Trump, where he'd love to be able to say he did a lot of stuff, and but keep corporates profitable, I think is what he'd love to be able to do. And so maybe that's it's no longer the tailwind it was for that sort of 50-year period from 1960 to 2010. It hasn't turned into a headwind. And the question is, I guess I'm laying this one and saying I don't have a good feel for which way it's going, but I know it's important to keep an eye on it.
I think there may be some sectorial differences because I think of the AI and what's happening there with regard to chips, or if I compare that to the car industry, or maybe defense, we could perhaps see some different forces pulling in different directions. So it does, I think, show you this is quite complicated now.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things that actually does go back to that is the supply chains, as we saw during the pandemic, the supply chains are very complicated. But in the really high tech stuff, particularly the chips, they are they're very hard to replicate. It's one thing to say, okay, I'm making, like you saw in the pandemic, and certain parts of houses that went into the joists or something like that, people worked out actually these are only made in two factories globally because they're so cheap and they're so ubiquitous. Can we do it? Yeah, they're an easy thing to do. We could dial up a part and do it, build a factory in Australia without any problems. It's just that one in Australia is going to be producing 100,000 a year, whereas there's two factories globally producing the entire world thing, and they can do it at a much cheaper price for around the world. That's not the case in chips, because in chips it tends to be somebody's got the know-how to do whatever, the world's flattest mirror, and it's one atom from one side across to the other. Is it's not just something someone in Australia can suddenly say, oh, that'd be a great idea, why don't I do that as well? And some of the machines that go into that literally just have thousands and thousands of parts that are going into these, and from specialist suppliers all over the place. And so it's very hard to unwind. And so I guess what I'm saying is that the technical knowledge that's going in that, and that technical knowledge keeps getting more and more and more, and so much specialization is, I do think that sort of lends a trend to world trade not really falling, despite the best efforts of Trump. But I think simpler processes, yeah, you can absolutely replace them. It's the complex processes that I just think are very difficult to stop trade.
And the other factor I'd just throw in there as we move into the next one is the energy, relative energy costs. So we've got an issue in the UK at the moment where there is one ethylene plant now left in the UK, which is the only one that can actually produce the critical resource there to enable a whole lot of manufacturing processes to work. And the government's just announced they're going to throw some money at it to stop it closing because they would have had to actually have then imported all of that ethylene from somewhere else around the world. So it shows you that there are actually some very interesting areas where the ability to be able to do stuff is being crimped. And the reason the ethylene story is what it is because the cost of energy in the UK for manufacturers is four times what it is in some other places around the world. And that takes us significantly into the mega trends around energy costs.
Yeah, that's right. And that the part, look, the interesting thing I want to do for this, because I want to pitch this as this. I've got this first chart on the left here, which is just showing the solar costs over 70 or 80 years, and you basically it's a straight line down, as you can see. It's just like the fall has been so incredible, but it didn't matter because all you're using it for was satellites and spaceships and things like that, And then gradually it hit this point. And then the chart on the right is now showing, okay, so utility solar is now cheaper than all these other measures, but it obviously can only be used for part of the day. And so we're in this weird situation right now where what you really need is you need the storage as well. You need to look at this and say, and that's that top blue line is solar plus storage, and full shifting storage. That's really what is the upper bound on these prices. And we saw during the Ukraine war where energy prices all took off, is that we actually sort of the coal price sort of peaked out at pretty close to where that level is. So we're not there yet. We're still some time away from that being this measure. But it means that there's all these weird economics going on where the cheapest, and that's where I wanted to jump to this next slide, is I've got the levelized energy costs. And this is sort of, to keep in mind, these are ballpark figures. They change depending upon where you are in the world and all that type of stuff like that. But you're sort of basically saying, look, for 3 cents, I can produce utility solar or utility wind. Now, they're not constant, so you can't use it for your entire network. And actually, if you try, you're just going to wreck, if you put too much of it in, you're going to wreck your network because you need that base load and things like that as well. So you need to maintain some of that. Now, those costs are based on being able to get being in a spot where you can actually tap into the network. So there's some you need to have the transmission as well there. And so really the cheapest source out here is solar that can tap into the transmission network in the right spot. Now that's not all solar, and particularly now we're having to build more and more transition to fit in with these. The next stage is then you go then you go look at natural gas, and you go, well, natural gas is a little bit more expensive, and I'm going to use it at say the 5 MMBTU, which is the it's It's sort of where Australia, it's probably a bit above, it's a bit above where Australia is. Sorry, between the three and the five is the US at the moment. But basically what it is that your cost without, with just the factory is sort of 2 cents, and then you've got to pay for the fuel. And so depending upon how expensive that fuel is, you're either sitting right down the bottom of the cost curve if you're in the US at that sort of between three and five. If you're at Australia, which is sort of closer to the 10 MMBTU, all of a sudden you jump past all these other things. You jump past all these coal and things like that, because the energy costs are so much more expensive. And then if you go to sort of the $20 or $30 per MMBTU, which is sort of where we sort of hit, it actually went much higher than that, but you know, at Russian invasion prices, now you're saying, okay, well, everything makes sense. Even solar plus batteries is really starting to make sense at some of those really extreme prices. And it's sort of similar with coal, except coal's a bit weird in that it's the upfront costs are bigger for coal, but the ongoing fuel costs are cheaper. And so we're in this weird part where, okay, so solar is this cheap. Now, if you've already built your coal-fired power plant and you've got your transmission already built to it, now you're probably the next cheapest in Australia in terms of that. Or maybe it's gas if you're at the right price, but it's probably coal if you've already built it. The question is saying, well, if I have to go and build a new one though, and particularly if I have to need to go build the new transmission, well, now I'm not more cheaper. And so a lot of the arguments you see from people about, oh, how expensive this one is or how expensive that one is all based around this whole part about, well, if you've built yourself in the right spot, if you're already built and you've already got the transmission, then your costs are way, way lower than if you have to go and build something brand new and build all the transmission for it. As battery costs come down, this is going to solve it's going to solve itself. You know, 10, 20 years from here, those battery costs will get to the point where, okay, that's the cheapest regardless of what you're doing. It's solar plus batteries or wind plus batteries. But we're in this period now where we're going to have arguments for the next 10, 15 years because people can show, oh, look how much cheaper this gas-fired power plant is than solar because of all the transmission you have to build or all the wind transmission you have to build. But the argument you need to be focusing on is less about, sort of a dogmatic, this is the right technology to be on, but more of this thought about, look, it's either a scarce asset or you've got these technological gains, and where do we hit these technological gains where the power storage reaches a level that fits on that prior graph I was sort of showing that, you know, that blue line gets below all these other lines. We're still a fair way away from it, but if it keeps going the way it's been going for the last decade, we are going to see that line meet relatively soon, which will solve a lot of problems. In the interim, it's going to be a mess. And there's a lot of people who are very focused on looking backwards at historical costs and not looking forward at that lines. And so that's where, you know, as you're putting your investments together, you really need to be thinking about not where's this going, not where is it right now. Sorry, not where has it been, not where is it right now, but where are we going to be in 10 years' time? And making sure you're not stuck in the technologies that is like, yeah, it's a great technology if it's already built and if you've already got the transmission, but if you have to build a new one and build new transmission, it's no good.
Well, I think there's more spin and misinformation in regard to the debates about energy and energy policy than almost anything else, because depending on how you build the argument, you can make almost any of it look more expensive or cheaper. Of course, the truth is that a lot of the connectivity doesn't exist in the right places at the moment, and it isn't resilient enough. It's a problem in the UK. So they're actually paying wind farms to not generate power or just lose the power, because they can't get it in the system at the moment. And it shows you that there is no joined up whole of system thinking, which is what we need. And of course, in Australia, we've got this huge, huge, huge impulse because of the way that the gas price, which is driven off international markets, is driving electricity prices, which means that electricity prices are a lot higher than they should be. And then it goes right back to what we were talking about before in terms of trade. Well, if the energy prices are too high, it means that manufacturing can't survive. So all of these knock-on consequences of all of these things really show up again. And unfortunately, there's so many partial points of view being communicated without a thorough understanding of how it all joins up together. And as you say, you've got to take a long-term forward-looking view, not looking back in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, exactly. And I do think there'll be, you know, as the costs of I don't think we're going to see big changes in transmission costs. I think they're pretty locked in, and potentially even rising as you get, you know, more people and like that. But you are seeing storage costs just come down quite dramatically year after year after year. And that's the point where I think you'll start seeing more distributed. There'll be more. You'll get to a point where it won't be a problem for these, because that exact wind farm, you're basically saying, well, no, you're not allowed to build a wind farm unless you're building the batteries for it as well. We'll take this much power from you, but you need to store it, and we're not going to pay you for stuff you're not doing. And so, yeah, I think that's because you genuinely need that base load, and that's where you get that part. Or you'll be, yeah, community batteries and other things like that. But I think that's, this energy side is critical in terms of trying to work out which are the countries that are doing a bad job for it. And if you're getting manufacturer, if you're, manufacturer of whatever it is, and they've got lots of stuff in the UK, it's like, well, okay, they're doing a bad job of it. Do I think they're going to improve, or do I think they're actually stuck in this? They're going to be a high cost nation for a long, long time. Australia, I think, is ending up in that bucket as well, in that, look, we've got so much energy. We've got so much energy. We're one of the world's biggest energy exporters, but we've got these really high costs and no desire to solve the problem. And so manufacturers within Australia are going to be facing this problem until we see those solar costs come down far enough, and battery costs come down far enough that they can actually take advantage of it. And sorry, when I said solar costs, that's a I've misspoken there. The solar cost doesn't really matter anymore. It's so low, it just doesn't matter. It's the battery costs that actually need to come down. And so, yeah, that's where, but we're at least a decade away from that, even at, good rates. And that's a decade more of people arguing and complaining and, cherry picking data to suit their own argument.
Well, I was going to say, one of the longer term trends we should, it's not in our list, as it were, but the political environment and the toing and the froing and the change of direction and the squabbles that they have, that for me is one of the biggest risks in all of this, right? Because they're actually eating their own children in the process, because they're not dealing with some of these more important trends which they should be focusing on.
Yeah, so a little bit. I'm going to go against you a little bit on this one, because I do think there's a so let's say we pick the Australian environment. I think the parties have coalesced pretty close. Like they make it seem like the differences are much bigger than that they really are. And so I think corporates have had a pretty good role in this, and within the US as well. The corporates have done a good job of saying, let's pit these political parties at each other on stuff that doesn't really matter, but the stuff that really matters are corporate tax cuts and letting mergers go through and all these other things that we really want. Let's make sure they're all in lockstep, and they can fight as much as they like about whether a trans woman should be swimming on a swim team or whatever, because in the meantime we've just passed a bunch of tax cuts that's going to be and cut regulations and all these other things that's going on in the background. So yeah.
Very interesting observation, which perhaps explains some of the woke and anti-woke stuff that's going on. We won't go into that. But what we will go
No.
into is just one last mega trend. And it's one that when you walk around the streets, you really see it, right? And that's the obesity issue.
Yeah, that's right. So I should go over a longer chart than this, but it's risen from over 50 years. It has been a reliable factor for healthcare companies, and I guess for food companies as well, is that you get about 1 to 1.5% more people, or sorry, maybe sorry, 0.5 to 1% more people who are obese every single year for the last sort of 50 odd years. It's just that constant. And so what it means is, as a healthcare provider, you've just seen this. If you look and say, well, whatever, not complete, not whatever, but there's a lot, whether it's heart disease or knee reconstructions or all sleep apnea or whatever, there's a whole bunch of things you can come back to that really do make a difference, where weight makes a difference to it. And health providers in that industry have just had this natural tailwind, in that every year there's more and more people who are unhealthy and more people who are overweight. And so your base of consumers has just been growing and growing and growing, and that's been this 50-year trend. Now, interestingly, the last numbers we're getting out of the US and some globally as well, is this looks like it's stabilized, and it might even be falling now. Now, potentially this is, or probably is, the weight loss drugs that are out there, but it's quite a significant overall theme that's well worth thinking about in terms of investment portfolios, is that how much of the growth you've seen in healthcare stocks was because they are genuinely creating new products and you know, creating value and all that type of thing. And how much of it is because they've just had a bigger and bigger customer base every year. And it's not even doesn't even need to be growing population, because there's a growing population of people within that population that is just sicker and more overweight, and so you're just getting more customers that way. And so if that starts to go sideways or reverses, maybe there's some trends we're going to start seeing in terms of you know, healthcare and productivity within that sector that's going to improve just because we've got this these things changing. And so yeah, I think it's this is one again we won't tell this is absolutely the case of a 20-year trend, but if this has gone or 50-year trend, if we've risen, then now we're going to go sideways for a while and then start falling. There's going to be a lot of different flow-on effects from that in terms of what you want to invest in within your portfolio.
And I'll just make a point here. To me, the obesity story and the obesity drugs and the food industry and the the way that food is being processed and perhaps not necessarily as healthy as it should be are two sides of the same coin. And I find it quite fascinating that we've got now the situation where, because of the cost of living pressures on many people, they're having to compromise more on the quality of the food that they actually can grab and go for that to that cheaper, perhaps less healthy food. The drugs that then are being sold that can actually reduce some of the obesity that's been created. So there's a sort of a mutual reinforcing cycle there. And the other observation is that if you're a drugs company, and you have somebody going on to these weight loss drugs, you can almost guarantee they're going to be on those drugs for a long, 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 long time, which gives you a significant cash flow into the future. So there are big stakes here, and again, big political blocks and big influential blocks. And I wonder sometimes whether, in fact, the policies on helping people to actually eat more healthy and eat the right stuff is being pulled in the other direction by the weight loss industry saying, no, we can solve your problem another way, and you can just take this jab.
Yeah, well, that's right. And so it's an interesting thought, isn't it? It's this part where, you know, we've got, I mean, I think in a way what the rising obesity is effectively shown is, look, we've put so much work into our food technology and our food tasting stuff, is that I can sell people a packet of chips or whatever that they should just be eating a third of it, but they're not. They're going to eat it all. They're just going to sit there and keep because I've made it all the taste and I've got everything right and I'm hitting the right areas of the brain and all that type of stuff like that people are just going to sit there and eat the whole thing. And as you said, now we've created this drug to then say, well, because you've done such a great job at making people eat too much, now you're going to jab, we're now going to offset that by basically dulling down the senses, largely what these are doing, you're dulling down those hunger pangs. And so that, you know, so they can match. And then it's that question about, well, is this just an arms race? Are we just going to see food companies coming with something else? And yeah. But I think yeah, it is a question about, you know, what's the right thing to do? And then how does the food industry go between that? You know, do you get to the stage where you can, you know, the unhealthy food is actually not too bad. The unhealthiest of food maybe does all right in the insofar as people will go, well, I'll just eat that and then I'll have my jab and I'll, you know, I just won't eat as much of it or whatever. So if I'm going to eat something, I'll eat the worst stuff. Or do you get a shift back to more healthy food? It's hard to say. I think regulation would be very useful. And you know, as much as I disagree with a lot of what Kennedy Jr. is doing in terms of, well, most of the stuff he's doing within the health department, there is a, you know, he has got a focus on trying to say, well, you know, Americans should eat more healthily, and I do think that is a focus. You know, I'd love to see elsewhere as well, is that you actually have genuine government policy that says, okay, there's a limit on whatever it is. You know, I think there's, you know, I think the UK has obviously experimented with that, but I think Singapore's done a lot in terms of saying, I think the Singapore one is you can't sell drinks with more than X amount of calories in it. Yeah, sure, people can buy two drinks if they want, but I'm not gonna sell them a bucket of, you know, thousands and thousands of calories in one drink, you know, like it's intended for one person. I'm only gonna sell small sizes. And so I do think there's an element of that public policy. And so does that mean, yeah, what you're investing in should change? Probably.
It's fascinating because then you start thinking about that in the context of inequality, and perhaps there's more obesity amongst those in the less affluent sectors of society, the very people who are probably less well and potentially then a bigger target for some of the obesity drugs. You've then got the demographics playing in there too. And so you start to see how interconnected all of these different mega trends are. And the observation is they're not all pulling in the same direction, right? So when you actually about how you build your portfolio and think about what's going to happen in the long term, you've almost got to weigh up these various elements and try and actually figure out how all of the jigsaw puzzle fits together. And that's why this is quite a complicated but a really, really important story to spend some time thinking about.
Yeah. Now, we are going to jump into the next phase of this when I see you on the first Tuesday in
2026.
January.
Yes, that's right.
And that's actually talking about the shorter term, the medium term trends. So what's actually really going to make a difference to us in the medium term, you know, the things that are happening right now? Because none of these are like rush out and you've got to do something now. Mm. You're like, oh, I just found out about this weight loss stuff. I've got to rush out and change my entire portfolio. It's like, no. It's not going to happen overnight. It's just going to be this gradual change where you're going to wake up in, you know, 10, 15 years' time, and all of a sudden you're going to see maybe that Pepsi and stuff like that is a much smaller company because they just don't sell as much, or maybe they've managed to keep on, but you know, it's much more healthier foods, or you know, there's those types of trends that are going to happen over these long periods of time. When we speak in the new year, we're going to be speaking about, right, what's happening right now, what do we need to worry about for 2026 and 2027, what are the key sort of trends that are going to be drive performance over that period. But yeah, well worth framing it first in this frame about what are these big long-term trends. You should at least be aware that, yes, something's just happened for the last 50 years, but I can't expect it to keep happening because something's changed. Or sometimes maybe I can because it hasn't changed.
Mm, absolutely. Well, I look forward to that next conversation early in the new year. And meantime, we wish our viewers, listeners, and followers a very happy holiday season. Take care, keep well. And Damien, I look forward to catching up with you next year.
Have a great Christmas, Mike.
Cheers.